All right, so it is New Year's. I can't even believe it. You know, it's getting cliche to say how fast everything passes, but you know, just because it's cliche doesn't mean it's not true. Because I don't know about you all, but I can't even believe it. Because you watch, here it is, January 3rd. Before you know it, it's going to be June. It's just amazing how the years go. It was interesting. I was driving my 14-year-old to a friend's house yesterday. And I asked him, so, you know, it's New Year's. Do you feel any different? He said, no. I said, now, does it seem to you like the years go fast or do they take a long time? And I was expecting a certain answer from him, and I got it. He says, no, they take a long time, you know. He's 14 years old. And, you know, it's interesting how you get older, and I'm sure you've all experienced this. It seems like the years go faster, don't they? And what is the reason for that? You know, I have my theories. Seems like if you're 1 year old, a year represents 100% of your life, right? If you're 14, it's only a 14th, and by the time you're 50, it's only a 50th of your experience. So it just doesn't mean as much, I guess, in terms of real time. Or, you know, perhaps if you're closer to the end than the beginning, I don't know, maybe you value it more. It's kind of like Einstein said about time and relativity. Remember that one? He said, put your hand on a hot stove for a minute, and it feels like an hour. Sit with a pretty girl for an hour, and it feels like a minute. That's relativity. So, leave it to Einstein to make the difficult thing simple, huh? But it's true. Things are just going so, so quickly. Maybe it's just the bits of data that we're asked to process every moment. I mean, there is so much coming at us from all different directions. I really don't know the answer to that. But what I do know is subjectively, I can't believe that it's New Year's again. And for many of us, 2010 was a pretty difficult year. It's kind of like, good riddance, don't let the door hit you on the donkey on the way out. You know, that kind of thing. On the donkey. Come on, guys, you know, don't let the door hit you. That was a good one? All right. But it was a tough year. It was a tough year for the nation. It was a tough year for the world. And it was a tough year for many of us individually. And the thing is, are we looking with any more hope to 2011? I mean, statistically, yeah, all right, Jennifer is. But she's in the minority in terms of if you survey the nation, it seems like there's a lot of pessimism going down around there. People not sure what's coming up. A lot of people still unemployed. A lot of difficult things as we look forward to the new year. And so how do we approach this thing? You know, Jesus told us right here at John 10:10, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Abundant life. You know, we're not just supposed to be living and breathing and surviving. We're supposed to be living abundantly. So in a difficult year, coming out of a difficult year, going into a year that's predicted to also be difficult, how do we live abundantly? What is it that we can do in order to make this thing work the way Jesus intended for it to? If we're his followers, if we're really, truly living in his word, then there's supposed to be something qualitatively different about our lives as we go forward. And I know it's difficult to do that some days. It's difficult for me many days to do that, and all of us. I have a little different approach this morning. I want to take three songs that I think give us clues into what Jesus is talking about and how we can accomplish the thing that we're trying to do here. And I also want to take a page out of Pastor Mike's playbook here and play you a little clip of one of the songs, because it comes from a movie, and kind of a movie you wouldn't expect to hear from the pulpit, I don't think, Victor Victoria. Have all y'all seen it? Okay. It's an interesting movie. It's Blake Edwards, who just died, what, 3 weeks ago? I hope Julie Andrews is doing okay. She was married to him. But he produced and directed it and wrote it, and she starred in it, and it's getting to be 30 years old. I think it was 1982. But it was a story of a starving soprano in Paris in the 1930s who can't get work and is to the point where she's literally starving to the point of passing out and is ready to trade her virtue for a meatball with her landlord to let her stay in the house. And at this point of extreme duress, she meets up with a homosexual in 1930s Paris, who together they decide the thing for her to do is to pretend to be a man, pretending to be a woman, and launch a new singing career. And it works, and she becomes the toast of Paris within weeks or months. And in the process, a man comes from the United States that she falls in love with, but she has to make a choice now. You know, does she choose her career, which includes this pretending, or does she go with her feelings? And the whole movie kind of leads up to this moment that we want to play you. Is that going to be possible, Greg? It's still working? Okay. The whole you never know. The whole movie leads up to this point and then leads away from it. This is like this critical, pivotal point. And the song is called Crazy World, and it was written by Henry Mancini and Leslie Bricusse, two of the absolute, you know, just lions of songwriting. And it's a beautiful song. Go ahead and see if you can roll it there, Greg.
Crazy world, full of crazy contradictions, like a child. First you drive me wild, and then you win my heart with your wicked art. 1 minute tender, gentle, then temperamental as a summer storm. Just when I believe your heart's getting warmer, you're cold and you're cruel, and I, like a fool, try to cope, try to hang on to hope. Crazy world. Every day the same old roller coaster ride. But I've got my pride. I won't give in. Even though I know I'll never win. Oh, how I
why would I include this morning? You know, this song to me just spoke volumes. It just happened that Victor Victoria came on television last week, and I happened to flip through. And every time it seems like I run across this movie, I got to watch it from wherever I start to the end. And I hit that song, and it just struck me, Crazy World. And it's the crazy contradictions in our world that make it so difficult for us to move through. Our world is full of paradox. It's full of things that don't make sense. It's full of difficulties and trials and tribulations and all these things that run counter to our expectations, run counter to our goals, and we wonder why God would place all these things in our path and all of these contradictions and things that just don't make any sense. This is a song that you won't leave the theater humming. It's not one of those kind of songs, is it? It's a sophisticated song. It's a grown-up song. It's a song that doesn't have the normal form and repetition to it. It doesn't go verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus. And so you don't hear things repeating. It's kind of unpredictable, and it kind of winds its way through this beautiful path. And I got to thinking, it's just like life, isn't it? It's the way life is. It's not predictable. It doesn't go where you think it's going to go. And so this song represented a lot for me this morning. And I'm bringing it to your attention because that last line is the key to it all. After all of these things that take us left and right in all these places that we don't expect, and we encounter all these contradictions. The tensions in life that seem to give us so much pain, can we learn to love that crazy world? Can we learn to love those crazy contradictions in a way that makes them no longer our enemies, but our friends? Can we come to terms with the way that life is presented to us? Let it wind its course and stop trying to force it into certain parameters and places and things that we think it should go. Life is full of tension. It's full of these crazy contradictions. So how are we supposed to live in the face of that? Well, let me ask you, how would you rather have it? If you could design this thing any way that you think it should be, how would you design it to be? Would you design a life that had no contradiction, had no tension, had no conflict? Would that be the way that it works? Remember, they tried that in The Matrix and they had to dump the thing and start over again. The thing is, what is it that keeps us guessing, interested, and alive in life? It's the difficulties, isn't it? Why do you go to see a movie? Why do you go to watch any of the television shows that you watch or read a novel or a book? It's the conflict. It's the tension. It's the tension and release and the tension and release again. Going back into the next wave of tension that keeps you interesting, that moves the plot forward, that moves you along with it. Without it, what have you got? Boredom. You're not going to stick with it. And what about a game, or any game, from a board game to a sporting game to anything that we play? What is it that makes the game fun, that makes the game interesting, that makes you want to come back and play again and again and again? You golfers know the answer to that. It's just hard enough. Mike said it perfectly. It's just hard enough that it keeps you interesting. If the game wasn't difficult, you would be bored. If you understood it completely and could play it, why is tic-tac-toe not really a fun game beyond being six? I mean, Brennan still likes it. I was playing it with him at the restaurant yesterday, you know? And I had to let him win because it's too easy. It's not a game that we can sustain ourselves with. It's the difficulties. It's the tension that keeps things interesting. And it's no different with life. If life didn't contain the tension and the crazy contradictions, we would be bored with it. It wouldn't hold our interest. So, this tension is something that I've called before a sacred tension. I know I've mentioned it here before. But let's just go through it again really quickly. Life is designed with this sacred tension at its core. When you think about it, if you're just standing up, are you at peace? Are you at complete peace? If you were, you'd be a flaccid puddle on the floor. You would fall down. Your muscles are in tension just to keep you upright and to keep you balanced. It's a necessary place to be. We always want to flop down on one side or the other. You know, of all the great controversies in life, whether is it faith or is it works? Is it predestination or is it free will? Is it Republican or is it Democrat? You know, we always want to go down on one side or the other because that seems to be a safe place to be. We want to come to rest. But what did Jesus say at Matthew 10:34? Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but the sword. There is an inherent tension. There is a holding together of things that are paradoxically at odds with one another in the spiritual journey. In an authentic spiritual journey, we hold things together that don't seem to fit. In another life, I was a cable splicer for General Telephone. I used to climb telephone poles and fix wires and such. You know where telephone poles always are? They're on property lines. And so when you look down from about 15 feet up, what you're looking down at is usually the top of a picket fence or a briar bush or something equally unpleasant to fall on. But it's always on the property line. The borders are uncomfortable places to be. We don't like to be there. We want to cross over to one side or another and be safe in our camp. But what Jesus is trying to teach us to do is to ride the border. On Saturday, when we go to Mexico, the most difficult place is always at the border. Are they going to let us through this time? You know, are they going to confiscate our load this time? Are they going to understand what we're trying to tell them this time? Do I have the right documents to get back this time? The borders are difficult places. We're uncomfortable there. We want to pass through. But what Jesus is trying to teach us to do is to stay balanced. It's like flipping a coin and learning to make it land on its edge and to stay there. And it sounds difficult, but if you can learn to love the border, if you can learn to love the tension that keeps things interesting and vibrating and alive, it changes everything. You know, the Jews had a very different way of thinking and a very different way of writing, and it makes it very difficult for us to read our scriptures because we are children of Greek logic and we want everything in a nice straight line. We go from premise to conclusion and we have all these ordered steps on how to get there. And everything has to align and everything has to go to a single truth because there is this logical concept called, you know, the non-contradiction law, which means that only one thing can be true at the same time. And so we want to harmonize everything. And then we look at these scriptures that are giving us stuff that just doesn't harmonize. I mean, at one point in the scriptures, God says, I will never leave or forsake you. And then the psalmist says, David in Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus echoes that on the cross. What's going on? Does God never leave or forsake, or does he forsake? The Hebrews have something called block logic that we're studying in our Wednesday class. It's unlike Greek logic. Because of block logic, the Jews in the scriptures simply lay down two truths that are both true at the same time, and they lay them right down next to each other, and they don't even bother to try to resolve them or harmonize them or squash them into one thing that makes sense logically. It's okay. Because one truth is looking at it from God's perspective and the other truth is looking at it from man's perspective. And we have different perspectives, but both are true. Will God never leave us or forsake us? Absolutely. Does it feel sometimes as though he has? Absolutely. And so the things are just laid down with no attempt to harmonize. And then us poor Greeks run around in circles chasing our tails for 2,000 years trying to figure out how to do just that, you know. But it wasn't meant to be done. The Jews are willing to let the crazy contradictions stand. I wanted to read a couple paragraphs to you from a book called Our Father Abraham that was our textbook on Wednesday night. And listen to what Marvin Wilson, the author, writes about this very phenomena. It's really important for us to get this if we're going to find abundance in a crazy world. The Hebrew knew that he did not know all the answers. That's the first line. The Hebrew knew he did not know all the answers. His position was under the sun. That's from Ecclesiastes 8. And so his words were few. He refused to over-systematize or force harmonization on the enigmas of God's truth or the puzzles of the universe. He realized that no one could straighten what God has made crooked. All things, therefore, did not need to be fully rational. The Hebrew mind was willing to accept the truths taught on both sides of the paradox. It recognized that mystery and apparent contradictions are often signs of the divine. Did you get that? Mystery and apparent contradictions are often signs of God. Stated succinctly, the Hebrews knew the wisdom of learning to trust in matters that they could not fully understand. Neither God nor his word may be easily contained in a box or for logical or scientific analysis. Both God and his word have a sovereign unpredictability that defies rational human explanation. Jewish biblical scholar Pinchas Labide writes this provocative word for Christians to ponder. Jesus was certainly no theologian in any Western sense of the word, because he was a Jew. Like the prophets before him, he gave concrete biblical answers to the pressing questions of daily life, poverty, payment of taxes, feuding between relatives or colleagues, and daily subsistence. He would certainly have detested as arrogant blasphemy any attempt to unravel and neatly systematize the mysteries of God. In a similar context, Lapide reinforces the above point by commenting on the Gentile Christians who try to squeeze Jesus and his paradoxes into a logical straitjacket. Says Lapide, Jesus is still protesting, I am no cleverly thought out book. I am a human being with all the inherent contradictions. Lupita's point is well taken. It drives the Christian back to the Gospels to consider anew such sayings as Matthew 10:34, in which the Prince of Peace says, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to this earth. I did not come to bring peace, but the sword." The Semites of Bible times did not simply think truth, they experienced truth. As we have previously emphasized, truth is as much encounter as it is proposition. This experiential perspective on reality explains in part why Judaism never really developed vast systems of thought. It also allows us to understand how Judaism could live with tensions and paradoxes surrounding block logic. To the Jew, the deed was always more important than the creed. You love that? The deed was always more important than the creed. He was not stymied by language that appeared contradictory from a human point of view. Neither did he feel compelled to reconcile what seemed irreconcilable. He believed that God ultimately was greater than any human attempt at systematizing truth. Walking in truth and living the truth were a higher priority than rationally analyzing the truth. In the words of the renowned biblical scholar, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, "We Jews are practical. We are more interested in discovering what God wants man to do than we are in describing God's essence. As a teacher, I never try to solve questions because most questions are unsolvable." He concludes, "Judaism is never afraid of contradictions. It acknowledges that full reconciliation of the two is possible only in God. He is the coincidence of opposites." I love that. The coincidence of opposites. Sounds like another way of saying crazy contradictions to me. The coincidence of opposites. You know, for us, these crazy contradictions, these opposites, these opposing forces in our lives, these things that come against us, are the things that make life unbearable. Because we think we need to figure out and resolve them. We think we need to harmonize everything and bring it together. I had a friend who came to me just the other day, and we were talking, and he said, "You know what? I've got to work something out. There's not enough money, and I've got to go forward, and I got people telling me, friends, that I need to be open to what job God may have for me." And that's a simple phrase, and it's a typical phrase that we use for each other all the time. What does God have for me? What job would God have me take? And so that implies in our thinking that we've got to get this all figured out before we move out. What does God want me to do? And the tension and the pressure is to try to figure all that stuff out and then move out. I had a friend who always used to say, "You know, you don't need to go." I'm sorry. "You don't need to know. You just get up and go." And he was always being led by the Spirit. It was kind of annoying, actually, you know. But anytime he tried to plan anything, then he was just there to say, "No, you don't need to go. Just get up and go. Just go for it. Just get started." I had another friend who said, "You know, when you do a sermon, Dave, all you need is the first line. Just know what the first line is. Say that and the rest will come. The Spirit will lead you. You don't need to know." You know, look, all these notes I got. I didn't take that advice. But the point is that there's a balance there. It's not that we don't ever plan. It's not that we don't ever prepare and take notes, but we don't become slaves to them either. And the most important thing is we don't feel that we have to wait to have everything figured out before we can go. Life doesn't work that way. God doesn't work that way. And spirituality doesn't work that way. The path is not clear before us. It's just not. Even when we think it is, in your experience, doesn't it change once you get there? Whatever you think it's going to be, whatever you have laid awake at night and drawing these maps in your mind, and you get out, and the map is not the territory, is it? Things change. In fact, it's like that car commercial I saw one time where the road is materializing as the car approaches. It's more like that. You can't see the path ahead. It materializes under your feet. Each step you take, there's something solid, and you move out that way, seeing basically one step at a time. It's all you get. There was a a famous writer, ethicist back in the 60s, 70s, named James Kavanaugh, who was having his midlife meltdown, and he decided to take a trip and a sabbatical to India, to Calcutta, to spend time with Mother Teresa and to try to figure it out. And he was just losing it completely. So he gets to the House of the Poor in Calcutta, and the first day he meets Mother Teresa, and she says, "Well, what can I do for you?" And he says, "Oh, Mother, pray that I might have clarity." And she said, "No, I won't do that." And he was absolutely shocked and taken back, of course. "Well, what do you mean?" You know, he says, "You always seem to have such clarity." And she says, "No, clarity is the last thing that you're holding on to and must let go of." "But what about you? What about your clarity?" She says, "I don't have clarity. I have trust. I will pray that you have trust." You see, we're looking for clarity, which means we want to understand everything so that we can remove all risk before we take the next step. We want to remove all the paradoxes, all the crazy contradictions. We want to have all that cleaned up before I take that first step. This is my insurance policy you're messing with. Don't mess with my insurance policy. What Teresa is saying is, I have no clearer idea of the path before me than you do. And if it looks like I do, if it looks like I can move through life serenely, confidently, it's because I simply trust that the path will materialize under my foot with the next step that I take. That's it. She didn't know any more than Jim Kavanaugh did, than any of us do, than Moses, Peter, Paul, James, any of the figures from Scripture that we hold up and revere for their faith so greatly, had no more of a clue what was going on than we do. But they had trust. The space between clarity and trust is all the room we need to start to learn to love this crazy world, to make peace with the crazy contradictions. Sometimes I look at my sons and my daughters, and Marion and I just kind of shudder, and we wonder, what is the world going to be like for them in 10, 20 years? It's changing so fast and getting so difficult. And that's a normal sentiment that parents always feel. The second song, and the lyrics are on your sheet there, come from Johnny Clegg. I don't know if any of you have heard of Johnny Clegg. He is an Englishman who grew up in South Africa. He is called the White Zulu. He speaks fluent Zulu, and he became a musician back when apartheid was still a huge part of South Africa's culture. And his message and his music was very political in nature. And he was caught up in the tensions between black and white and political struggles. And when he wrote this song in 1988 called Cruel, Crazy, Beautiful World, there it is again, right in the title, those paradoxes, Cruel, Crazy, Beautiful World. He was talking to his son, Jesse. And just this little clip that I have here, beyond the door, strange, cruel, beautiful years lie waiting for you. It kills me to know that you won't escape loneliness. Maybe you lose hope, too. And then he says, ayeye, ayeye, Jesse Mpana, ayeye, ayeye. In Zulu, ayeye means joy, celebration, sheer happiness. It's just a general word that they use to just express this festive, joyous spirit. They use it at soccer games and everywhere. Ayeye. He's telling him, even though these things will be coming your way, son, ayeye. Jesse Mfana, Jesse my boy, ayeye. Celebrate. When I feel your small body close to mine, I feel weak and strong at the same time. So few years to give you wings to fly, show you the stars to guide your ship by. It's a cruel, crazy, beautiful world. Every time you wake up, I hope it's under a blue sky. It's a cruel, crazy, beautiful world. One day when you wake up, I will have to say goodbye. Goodbye. And then the whole last end of the song is, it's your world, so live in it. It's your world, so live in it. Ayeye. This is our world. Embrace it. Live in it. We are going to find the joy and the celebration, the ayeye, when we live in our world, when we accept it for what it is, we don't try to harmonize. We don't try to pray away the crazy contradictions in life. But we embrace them and we hold them together. This is what it's all about. The abundant life comes when we embrace the difficult things. Jesus' central point, the thing that he drove home and drove toward, it's kind of like I said, the whole movie led up to this point and led away from it. All of Jesus' teaching leads up to this point and leads away from it. He said, you got to learn to live like a child in a grown-up world. A grown-up, sophisticated, difficult, contradictory world. Can you learn to live like a child in it? Hold those paradoxes together. Don't try to separate them out, just like a child does. A child doesn't deal with paradox. A child accepts whatever the child sees, and the next thing the child sees, and just brings them together, and ayeye. Just celebrates and lives and plays. A child plays through the contradictions. A child becomes the contradictions in and of itself. The second line of Crazy World, you know, full of crazy contradictions like a child. The child is a walking contradiction. All these things floating through. Jesus is saying, can you do that? Can you learn to hold all these things, bring them together with a lack of tension or a lack of reconciliation of the tension? Because when it comes right down to it, if there is no tension, if there is none of this left in your life, that's just death. Jesus is coming to bring us life, but it includes these bits and pieces. We have gone over and over again the concept and the importance of the here and now, that this is the moment. This is the only moment. We're supposed to be focused and you know, embedded in the here and now, that Jesus' teaching is all about that, and that's true. But does that mean that we have no awareness of past or future? Of course not. Once again, that tension needs to be all brought together. Acknowledgement, remembrance of the past, and hope and awareness of the future brought together in this present moment. And so, since it's New Year's, the third song that I wanted to talk to you about is the one that we all sing every New Year's Eve, Auld Lang Syne. And have you ever really thought about what those words mean? What in the world are they singing about? Well, it just so happens that Peggy Noonan wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal called Days of Auld Lang What? And she's asking the same thing. I want to read you just part of what she wrote because it's going to drive the point home. You know exactly when you'll hear it, and you probably won't hear it again for a year. The big clock will hit 11:59:50, and the countdown will begin. 10, 9, 8, 6, 7, 5, 4. And the sounds will rise. The party horns, fireworks, and shouts of Happy New Year. And then they'll play that song. Should all acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should all acquaintance be forgot and days of Auld Lang Syne? It's a poem in Scots dialect, set to Scots folk tune. And an unscientific survey says that a lot of us don't think much about the words or even know them. Auld Lang Syne. The phrase can be translated as old long since or long, long ago, but I like old times past. It's a song that asks a question, a tender little question that has to do with the nature of being alive, of being a person on a journey in the world. It not only asks, but it gives an answer. It was written down by Robert Burns, lyric poet and bard of Scotland. In 1788, he sent a copy of the poem to the Scots Musical Museum with the words, "The following song, an old song of olden times, has never been in print." Burns was interested in the culture of Scotland and collected old folk tales and poems. He said he got this one from an old man, no one knows who, and wrote it down. Being a writer, he revised and compressed. He found the phrase Auld Lang Syne exceedingly expressive and thought whoever first wrote the poem was heaven-inspired. The song spread throughout Scotland where it was sung to mark the end of the old year and then to English-speaking world where it was sung to mark the new year. The question it asks is clear. Should those we knew and loved be forgotten and never thought of? Should old times past be forgotten? No, says the song. they shouldn't be. We'll remember those times and those people. We'll toast them now and always. We'll keep them close. We'll take a cup of kindness yet. The phrase old acquaintance is important, says a friend of mine. It is not only your close friends and people that you love, it's people you knew even casually, and you think of them and it brings tears to your eyes. For him, acquaintance includes your heroes, my heroes, the Winston Churchills of life, the ones you admire. They're old acquaintances too. But the interesting, more serious message in the song is that the past is important. We mustn't forget it. The old has something for us. So does the present, as the last stanza makes clear. The song is not only about those who were in your life, but those who are in your life. And there's a hand, my trusty friend, and give a hand of thine. We'll take a right good willy draft for Auld Lang Syne. The song is about friendship. I think it's a description of the things we lose in our hurry to do other things. We forget to be a friend. We have to take the time to make friends and be friends, to sit and tell stories and listen to those of others. The song is a staple in movies, too. But when I asked people to think of the greatest Auld Lang Syne scene, every one of them had the same answer. Not When Harry Met Sally or Out of Africa, not for film buffs Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush. The great Auld Lang Syne scene in cinematic history is from It's a Wonderful Life. The scene comes at the end of the film. Friends surround George Bailey, recently rescued by an angel, and someone bumps against the Christmas tree and a bell ornament makes a sound. George's daughter says, "Teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings." And George says, "That's right, that's right." And then he looks up and winks, "Attaboy, Clarence." And the music swells. Tonight I'll be at Susie and Joe's. I'll think of some who won't be entering the new year with us. And I'll take a cup of kindness yet for them, for all the old acquaintances in my life, and for the readers for 10 years now of this column. We mark an anniversary. Thank you for being in my life. Happy New Year. Auld Lang Syne is about friendship. It's about remembering the people that have made our lives in the present exactly what it is. It's bringing the past into the present. It's bringing the future into the present too. It's holding everything together. You know, you probably never heard more than the first verse of Auld Lang Syne. If you take a look at your flyers there, the last three stanzas are interesting. We too have run about the slopes and picked the daisies fine, but we've wandered many a weary foot since Auld Lang Syne. We too have paddled in the stream from morning sun till dine, but seas between us broad have roared since Auld Lang Syne. And there's a hand, my trusty friend, and give us a hand of thine. We'll take a right good will draft for Auld Lang Syne. For Auld Lang Syne, my dear, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne. When we can take all of these things and hold them together in our embrace, kind of like magnets repelling each other, and just let them do that, and just hold on anyway. When the memories of old times past can drive us deeper into this present moment, anchor us here, because of everything that brought us to this moment. And when the difficulties in this moment don't make us fear the future, but draw it into the present as well, it all comes together right here now. This is what Jesus is talking about. The life of the child that moves us into kingdom is just allowing the contradictions in life to be. Jesus told us at Matthew 28:20, "I am with you always, even to the end of the age." If we can hold on to that thought, we can move from trust to clarity, and clarity to trust. We can move from having to have things figured out to just knowing that the path will materialize under our feet. And we can learn to love our crazy world with its crazy contradictions. And we can look forward to a new year, trusting that things will be difficult and things will be perfectly okay. Let's pray. Oh, Father, another year. Sometimes it feels difficult to be equal to the challenges ahead of us. Another year and everything that we have to do, starting this afternoon, starting tomorrow morning. But Father, you are with us even to the end of the age. You promised us we're going to take it to the bank. We're going to trust that that is so. And no matter what we see, we're just going to keep moving forward with that belief. Help us to do that. Help us to be strong. Help us to not try to figure everything out. Help us to let some things just be. And to realize that if we don't know something, maybe we don't need to know it. Maybe it's just okay. And if we keep moving forward, we will learn something that will either take its place or make it clear or something, but just keep moving forward in you, Lord. That's what we want to do. Stop the worrying. Stop the paralysis and the debilitating stress and anxiety. Deal with what is in front of us. Help us, Lord, just to know that you are always with us and we'll be all right in you. Thank you for another year, Lord, another breath. Thank you for our family and our friends and our old acquaintances. We love you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.